Do I need a life coach? You're listening to episode 92 with Rhiannon Bush. Welcome to the Do I Need a Life Coach podcast. We're here to discuss the ins and outs of the life coaching industry and give you tools to use to see for yourself. I'm your host, Rhiannon Bush, mother, management consultant, and a passionate, certified life coach. Well, hello, my friends. I hope you had a wonderful Easter. We went away to the coast, which was just sensational. The weather again. It was lovely and refreshing. And, you know, when we drive back from the coast, because it's quite remote up there, as soon as I see the houses, I'm like, oh, darn it. It's just like this reality check of like, oh, yeah, okay, we're back to reality. But it was an amazing like 4 or 5 days that we had. And yeah, magical quality family time, lots of amazing food, lots of drinks, lots of beach time, lots of swims. We saw seals and dolphins. We saw wildlife. We went fishing, owls, possums, our usual wallabies and wombats. So it was a very, nature-filled Easter. It was great. And I hope you all had a wonderful, wonderful time. A few months back, I went to some family friend's house to celebrate. So to the end of year. So it was probably, 3 months ago. And we try to do that every year. And I've been friends with this family for a very, very long time. And now one of them, who's my age, has 2 children the same age as mine. So it's a really lovely, special thing to think that there are now 3 generations together and that's the way it happened. So we had some really amazing times over the many, many years as family friends, and we've done a lot of snow skiing together and just went through high school with them, and it's been great. But this particular evening over the Christmas period, the mum of the other family had said to us, to the parents of the younger kids, look, can you bring your kids' bikes so they can ride around outside while we're all having dinner? And of course, we said, yes, it's a great idea. Bikes are already in the car, so off we went. And it came to bike riding time and, you know, I pulled the kids' bikes out of the car and I looked at a ramp that they had and I thought, oh, that looks like fun. And I took my son up the hill with his bike and there was a bit of resistance on his part, but nothing major, and all the other kids came up the hill too. And then Parker hopped on and he went to go down the hill and he couldn't find his footing and he fell off his bike. And, you know, he scunned his knees and hurt himself quite badly. And anyone who has kids knows that when this happens and they're already very, very tired, things escalate and things get very dramatic. And sometimes that drama is warranted and other times it's just very, very heightened. And what they are feeling and experiencing is just more to do with tiredness and then a bit of pain as well. And so it all just perpetuates. I was also very tired. I was pretty burnt out around the end of last year, and that's another learning curve for me around setting boundaries and taking things a lot easier, and that's been really great this year. So far, I'm on track to be managing that a lot better. But I found myself in this spiral of thinking whether I had pushed him into going down that ramp, whether, you know, I should have just listened, you know, and I started feeling really guilty about taking him up there in the first place. And then I remember analyzing the reasons that I had done it. Was it about me showing him off? Was it about me wanting him to realize he could do that and have a lot of fun? Was it that I thought it was a bit of a challenge for him and that he would learn from doing it? And I just went into complete overanalysis mode. And I took him outside and gave him lots of cuddles, but he was very upset and he was disrupted. He was overtired and it just tipped him over the edge. So all I could really do in that moment was remove him from everybody else and give him lots of love, which I did. But when I went into that self-analysis mode, it was, you know, did I do the right thing? And if I could take it back, should I have done things differently? What could I learn from it? And now, even as I'm retelling this story, I realize I'm definitely overanalyzing it. You know, kids fall off bikes. It's something that happens, especially when they're tired, because they just don't seem to have that motor control. And he was definitely capable of riding his bike down that ramp. He's ridden down much, much bigger, steeper hills than that. He'd even done it earlier that day. So it really was just one of those things. But because I was tired and I felt bad, my son was hurting, I went into overanalysis mode. But it wasn't just because I was tired. You know, I'm in this place in life where I'm starting to look at people in my life more closely, and I'm starting to get some serious clarity on where they fit into my life, the value that I place on relationships. And I've never really spent a lot of time analyzing friendships because I could move in and out of them as I chose to. And it was just me, you know, and I was in big cities. So I had so many people around and I could just really have fun with the group. And then if things got awkward or things started to stagnate, I could move on. I know that it makes me sound incredibly fickle, but I had the ability to do that. And then when I met really special people that really resonated with me, they were the ones that I would choose to spend a lot of time with. Also at that time, I had so much time to be socializing. I was out all the time and I was a bit more forgiving along the way because I was used to socializing and I was used to being around people. And then COVID happened around the same time as I had kids. So not only was I, you know, feeling that isolation that you do, or a lot of people do as a young parent, but also then COVID. So I think being around crowds of people, you learn to socialize. Socializing isn't necessarily a natural innate skill that people have. So that was really, really interesting as well. And today my time is so limited, especially for social time, that that time needs to be very cup filling, not cup emptying. And I've always had a lot of people around me and I've loved that. I love socializing and I love being around big groups of people, whether it's been high school or university or overseas. And I've never had a problem making friends. But what I'm realizing much more now, I'm more time poor and in that kind of circumstance, I find myself questioning what I'm actually getting from specific relationships. And when I was traveling back from Hobart from an event recently, I realized just how wonderful some of my friendships truly are. They are compassionate, empathetic, kind, inclusive, strong. They're the kinds of friendships where, you know, we can debate and discuss ideas and I can be 100% myself. And we, all of us, accept one another for whatever opinions we have and we listen to one another. We have a safe space. While we might not agree, we can separate the opinion from the person to discuss it and broaden our viewpoint, or at least to consider a different perspective long enough to ponder it and maybe confirm our own beliefs or disprove our own beliefs on whatever it is that we're discussing. And that is such a beautiful thing. I was at a leadership conference last week. It was a breakfast and the topic was, if you knew one thing about leadership, it would be dot, dot, dot. And one of the things that one of the speakers spoke about was the fact that leaders don't have those courageous conversations and say those things that need to be said. They don't look at things from other people's viewpoints or perspectives. And it was hard for me to sit on my hands and keep my mouth shut because there's a TED talk based on a German, I think it is, organization that do Tinder for controversial topics. So, you know, abortion, voluntary euthanasia, they, you know, you can actually match up with someone who has an opposing viewpoint and you can meet in person to discuss and debate those different perspectives. And they are finding it a very peaceful process, but also a very collaborative process. And it's really helping people to broaden their views and just have an opportunity simply to ask somebody else, well, that's a completely opposite viewpoint to me. Why? Why do you feel that way? Where did that belief form? On what basis? On what grounds do you support that? And it just completely opens up the conversation. And those are the conversations that I want to be having. I want to be challenged and I want to be questioned, but I want it to be done in a very safe environment because that's a really beautiful thing. And what I feel when I'm around people that enable me to have those discussions is calm. I feel inspired. I feel valued and included, loved, connected. And that's how I want to feel. And this happens with old friends and new friends alike. It's interesting with older friends. Sometimes past events or old trials or tribulations that have occurred within friendship groups, you know, it may not ever be fully resolved. Or even if it has been, there's residue that remains and still taints the relationship, or it still comes up, or there is still the same dynamic and nothing ever progresses or changes because the dynamics of that group have been cemented from such a long time ago. And then when you've got residual thoughts or feelings by one or more people, then it does create that barrier to communication and authenticity. It is how our neuroscience typically speaking, our reticular activating system chooses to focus. So if we've been hurt by a person in whatever way, and this could be a parent when we were younger, this could be a lover, this could be a friend, this could be a sibling, especially when we're really young, you know, our RAS will continue to look for that happening again. And we will actually attribute traits of that person to other people. So sometimes in life, you might meet somebody and go, I don't like you. I don't know why, but I just don't like you. That's not made up. That is actually your reticular activating system clocking that person going, and somewhere deep in your subconscious mind, in your filing cabinet system, they're actually called gestalts, but they're in there, in a deep drawer somewhere way at the back under a whole bunch of other piles, your brain has pieced all of that together. And then you look at this person and your brain throws up signals at you going, no, because, and your brain is actually going, because you've experienced this in the past, this in the past, this in the past, this in the past, and that has all resulted in this thing. And now you don't like that person based on that. So that is how neuroscientifically that works, which is quite fascinating. But then you can see how unconscious bias feeds into that and how, you know, we are very much about stigmas because that's how we're conditioned, because that's how our brain likes to work to keep us safe. So, you know, if we think suspiciously or we're hurt or we don't trust other people, then we will unconsciously and continuously look for that and we will find it. It leads to a lot of misinterpretation and misunderstanding that can happen in a relationship, and it only makes things worse. In this scenario, focusing consciously or unconsciously on past experiences of hurt or betrayal can trigger suspicion and mistrust in current relationships. Our RAS, which filters information based on what we believe, which is done by choice, by being told, or by past experiences, it plays a crucial role in reinforcing these negative patterns of thinking and therefore what we're looking for in the world around us. When we've been hurt by somebody, our RAS is primed to detect similar behaviors or cues, and this perpetuates that cycle of suspicion and mistrust. Think about people you know who attract a type of intimate partner. So I've known quite a few girls in my past, actually guys as well, who have kept attracting people who cheat on them. Or I've had a lot of clients that have had multiple abusive partners or people who have kept attracting narcissists. And I'll give you a clue. It's a pattern within you that's causing it to keep coming to you or the person that you're thinking of. There's a common denominator, and that common denominator needs to do the work and the healing to stop attracting the very thing that they keep attracting. Additionally, overanalyzing situations and self-doubt can heighten those feelings of suspicion. So when I was overanalyzing the situation with my son on his bike, if I had been in a situation where I didn't currently or hadn't previously felt judged, then I most likely wouldn't have had those suspicions or considerations at all. The feelings of insecurity and judgment came from feelings of guilt and insecurity exacerbated by fatigue and being strung out because I had made assumptions based on how I thought they were perceiving me at 20 odd years old, which may not have even been true at the time, let alone now. It was the story I was telling myself. Furthermore, the evolving nature of friendships and the need to deepen our connections can lead to a reassessment of existing relationships. And maybe should. As priorities shift and time becomes more limited, there's a greater emphasis on nurturing relationships that are fulfilling and supportive. They're more fun. They're more validating. They feel better. And they are cup filling instead of anxiety filling and cup emptying. So I highly recommend evaluating the value you give and gain and the authenticity of friendships, distinguishing between those that contribute positively to our well-being and those that may be draining or lacking in genuine, safe connection, or that don't feel safe and supportive. Ultimately, finding evidence of mistrust within ourselves and others requires introspection and awareness of our thoughts, our past experiences, and our behaviors. So when we take time to recognize our past and how it is affecting our present state, we can work towards fostering healthier relationships built on trust and empathy and open communication, not only with ourselves, but with others. And this involves recognizing and then challenging our negative beliefs and practicing forgiveness and compassion and cultivating a mindset of curiosity and acceptance towards other people. We want to cultivate positive beliefs about how others perceive us, And that starts within ourselves. And what I realize now is that it's a choice. It's my choice to buy into negative assumptions about how people feel or the positive. So either way, my opinion is really the only one that matters. And I would rather be positive and optimistic about who I am and what I contribute to others than buying into the story I tell myself or assumptions I make where I may go down into negative rabbit holes. Knowing who I am and my positive and negative qualities is so valuable. Being aware helps me navigate when I want to use what and what I get to focus on and buy into and what I don't. So for example, like I'm not demure. I'm not stoic. I'm not a wallflower. In some circumstances, this doesn't work for me. And being outspoken and spicy is actually a detriment to the optics of me as a professional or to somebody who is a bit shy and demure. I can come across as very full on and very opinionated. And there are other circumstances, it's perfect and valid and warranted. By having awareness, I know when I need to censor myself and manipulate my behavior to protect the perception others have of me. So while in other circumstances, I can be 100% authentically myself. It just depends on the circumstance and the outcome and consequently how I feel, because censoring myself feels terrible. I think censoring oneself always feels terrible. So if you do it, it needs to be worthwhile. Cultivating positive self-beliefs about how others perceive us begins with cultivating positive self-perception. Our beliefs about ourselves profoundly influence our interactions with others and what we project out into the world and how others see us, and then how we interpret their actions and responses. So you can see that it's sort of like it's almost like an energy that goes out and then it's gauged by other people and then it's mirrored back to us. And when we hold positive beliefs about ourselves, like we feel worthy, we're confident, we're deserving of respect and love from others, and we project that confidence outwardly, that can shape how we are perceived by others and how they respond to us. It acts as a filtration system through which we interpret the feedback and reactions we receive from others. So if we believe that we are competent and capable, we are more likely to interpret constructive feedback as helpful and useful rather than it being a personal attack on our abilities and making us feel vulnerable. Alternatively, if we hold on to negative beliefs about ourselves, like feeling inadequate or unworthy, we may interpret even well-intentioned feedback as confirmation of our perceived shortcomings. So this also impacts our self-perception and can influence our behavior and communication style, which in turn affects how others perceive us. When we feel confident and secure in ourselves, we are more likely to express ourselves authentically, and we are to assert what we want, set boundaries, and have healthy and evenly balanced relationships. On the other hand, when we have self-doubt or insecurities, we may be hesitant, defensive, we may lack confidence, and that also impacts how others perceive us and respond to us and how happy we are in our lives. So working on those positive self-beliefs we have about ourselves starts with you. It is so important for cultivating positive self-image and relationships and maintaining a reasonable perspective of how others perceive us. And to do this, we can practice self-awareness and challenge our negative self-talk when we recognize it. We can also embrace compassion and acceptance of ourselves, our good, our bad, our ugly, all of the pieces of us, not just the good or trying to block out the bad. Embrace all of you. Also, start with a list. I do this with most clients I work with. Start with a list. All the things that you like about yourself. Write them down. Don't stop until you get to 21. Because what'll happen? You'll go, oh, I can't do that. And then you'll sit there and you'll get to 5. And then you'll stop and you'll go, that's it. That's all I got. And then you'll get a whole new wave of, oh, yeah, but I like this, this, and this, and this. And then you'll pause again. And then you'll go, oh, and I like this, and this, and this. By the time you get to 21, you could get to 50. So you just sit down and start there. Because by working on having a mindset of self-worthiness and confidence, you know, we can lean into our authenticity and we can harness those things that we really love about ourselves, and that helps us accept the parts we don't. The foundation of having a strong sense of self that we feel really positively about is the beginning of discovering and exploring new and existing fulfilling ways that are supportive in relationships we have around us. Relationships that are grounded in that trust and mutual respect, authenticity, and where you can truly be yourself, your perfect, worthy self. I will see you next week. Thank you so much for joining me on this insightful journey today. If you've resonated with what we've discussed and feel inspired to make positive changes in your life, I'm here to support you. Remember, your transformation begins with a single step. If you're ready to take that step and explore the possibilities of working with a life coach, visit my website at www.rhiannonbush.com. There, you'll find more information about my coaching programs and how we can collaborate to achieve your goals. Your journey to a more fulfilling life starts now, so reach out today and let's create the life you dream about. Until next time, take care and keep moving forward.